What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. I tried to end my life. My friend Josh Ellen is here to share his story, to offer some hope and encouragement. This is going to be tough, and so if there's some pauses or things like that, then you understand why. But this is his story, and it's kind of recent, and so just bear with him. Let him share his story and share this with others as he goes to offer hope and encouragement to you and anybody that you know that may be in a similar situation, struggling with some depression, anxiety, fear, things like that. This one is called sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/overdose. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/overdose, as that's part of Josh's story. So without much further ado, Josh, we're going to let you get to your story. I have Bubba Wilson here, and we're going to be again sharing Josh's story, asking him some questions, and going from there. So, Josh, I really appreciate you stepping up, being willing to share your story, and that we're able to walk through this with you.
It's my pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you. Let me tell you the purpose of why I'm sharing the story. The purpose really comes from my journey of not only cancer, but everything that I went through. And when I share the dates and timelines, hopefully there'll be some understanding of what ended up happening. And I'm not doing it to be cathartic. I'm not doing it to have any sort of sympathy or empathy. I'm doing it to share my story so that if there are any other people that are just going through a hard time, if they're battling cancer, if they're battling depression, if they're battling anything that seems to be challenging them, then, in my opinion, I'm obligated by the code to share my story in an effort to just help other people. So before I also start, I've got a family friend Ricky Horn, and hopefully he's listening now from California. Ricky is battling bladder cancer, and he's going in for a major operation on Friday. And Ricky, if you're out there and if you're listening, just know that we are sending you love and encouragement and strength. And remember the three things that we talked about. Your job is to go in alive, come out alive, and fight and battle alive. And when you're done, we'll stand at the top of our mountains and we'll hold hands and say that we stared cancer down in the face and beat it. So, moving on. I will tell you that my story that I'm aware of, and I'll tell you why I'm saying that I'm aware of it, started in June 29th, 2017. Just prior to that, we had been at the NATA National Convention in Houston, and it was a great meeting. I was part of the joint committee meeting. I serve on a national committee, the Professional Responsibility in Athletic Training. I was doing fine. It was just had just finished the spring semester and was finishing the first part of our summer semester. I was feeling good. I had no signs, no symptoms of anything that was going wrong. And after that, my mom was in her last stages of her battle with cancer. It was appendiceal cancer. It was very advanced. And I got a phone call from my dad that she didn't want to die in the hospital. So she was in the hospital and very, very unstable, very delicate situation. So my wife and I made a decision that after NATA Houston, we'd fly out. So we left from Hobby and flew into Southern California on June the 29th. And through a long, arduous process, was able to get Mom out of the hospital and get her back home where she was comfortable. On July the 3rd, On July the 3rd, I said goodbye to my mom, and she was very, very ill, very tired. And she looked at me and said, "This will be the last time that you and I see each other." To which I responded, "Possibly, most likely." And that I wanted to, the idea was that I wanted to fly back to California to see her, because I knew that she was in the terminal phases of cancer, and that we didn't have much longer to go. So flew back on July the 4th out of Orange County, California, flew into Javi, and everything was going great. Felt good, no headaches, nothing, until Saturday, July the 8th. And on Saturday, July the 8th, I drove my wife and daughter to the Javi Airport. Jessica, my wife, was to attend a conference in Chicago and was taking my daughter for that experience. And so I dropped them off at Javi Airport. I drove back home. And, you know, spent some time with my son. We watched a couple movies, laughed. And at some point in the early afternoon, on July the 8th, I told Matt, "Hey, let's clean the house so mommy doesn't have anything to worry about, you know, when she gets home." So stood up, started to clean the kitchen. And next thing I know, I'm on the couch. And the paramedics are in my house, and they are doing an assessment. I am completely unaware of what's happening. In medicine, we call it, I was postictal, because I had had a grand mal seizure, and my son found me. So that was my first sign and symptom that something was wrong. So I was taken to UTMB by ambulance, Victory Lakes, because I live in League City. And they did a number of tests, including CT, and they found a golf ball sized tumor in my right frontal lobe. Again, I had no signs or symptoms. I had nothing. So from there, I was transported to UTMB Galveston, because this was a neurosurgery. This is a neurosurgery issue that at the time UTMB Victory Lakes was not capable of handling. So I was transferred down there, and again, my wife and daughter are in Chicago. My son is the one that found me seizing. So he's the one that called 911. He's the one that communicated with my dad, who ended up communicating with my wife. And, you know, Jess and Rebecca were right back on a plane. We joke now that it was the most expensive lunch Rebecca will ever have. So they flew back, and I went through a number of more extensive tests, including contrast MRs, and they identified that, in fact, I had a golf ball-sized tumor in my right frontal lobe. And so that was on July the 8th, 2017. And on July the 11th, 2017, I had a craniotomy to remove the tumor. The original estimate for the operation was supposed to be 4.5 to 5 hours. They UTMB Galveston has something called an intraoperative MRI, and or an iMRI. So they operated me, and they felt like they got it all, and I went through the iMRI, and they realized there's still about 20% left. So you have to treat that like a whole new procedure. So a 4.5 to 5 hour procedure turned into about a 9 to 10 hour procedure. So I was under for 9 or 10 hours, and I can't imagine the amount of agony that my wife and kids and my family that had flown out, that they went through. Just waiting. Luckily, I was surrounded by a number of friends who were also my medical providers, including my anesthesiologist, who was the husband, or is the husband, of my primary care provider. So I had a lot of people that were watching out for me, and a lot of people that were watching out for my family and updating them and, you know, I got really lucky. The surgeon that operated me was a guy by the name of Dr. Juan Ortega, and Juan has since left to go to UT Austin to start up their neurosurgery residency. So if I don't know how he would be listening to this, but he is the absolute most talented, most compassionate neurosurgeon and physician I think I've ever met in my life. So I get out, and I come out of the operating room, and now all of these people are talking with me, including UTMB oncology. And I didn't realize why they were there. And I'll never forget, one of the UTMB oncology fellows showed up in a black jacket. And I yelled at him, "Get the F out of my room." You know, and I said, I'm not talking oncology, because the way that they talk about brain tumors is that they never talk about whether it's malignant or whether it is benign. It's always assumed that it's malignant. Gliomas are always malignant unless proven otherwise. So I couldn't figure out why oncology was there, but I knew after watching what my mom went through with chemotherapy and all that other stuff, I wanted nothing to do with it, and I wasn't going to have a conversation. So I guess at some point I told him, the reason why you're wearing a black jacket is because you're deaf, and you know, get out of my room. So he left my room. Anyway, on August the 3rd, I had to go back as a follow-up, and UTMB oncology. And then after that, I went for a second opinion at MD Anderson. And so that was on August the 3rd, 2017. August the 4th, 2017 was my daughter's bat mitzvah, and that went to August the 6th. On August the 9th, I returned back for the end of the summer semester, and remember, I was operated on July the 11th. On August 21st was the start of the fall semester. On August 22nd, United Healthcare denied my request for proton therapy because they didn't feel like it was necessary. Although MD Anderson had all the evidence in the world that proton therapy was the most effective form of radiation for gliomas, because it was very targeted and it didn't radiate my entire brain the way that photon therapy would radiate. So they denied me for proton therapy. On August 25th, Hurricane Harvey hit. 2 days after that, on August 27th, my mom died. A day after that, United Healthcare notified me that they're officially closing my case because of Hurricane Harvey, and that the University of Houston was switching to Blue Cross Blue Shield on September the 1st. So MD Anderson would not be open before that time, so there's no reason why they need to keep the case open. So they closed my case. On August the 31st, still battling all the things from Hurricane Harvey, we had to drive up to Dallas and flew back for my mom's funeral, and we're Jewish, and so the Jewish religion is that it is customary to bury somebody within 3 days of dying. And so mom died on the 27th, but her funeral was not until September the 3rd. And so she was in the freezer for that amount of time. And it must have been mother's intuition or something like that, but she knew somehow that on July the 3rd, that was it. That was the last time I was going to see her. And the next time that I saw her was on September the 3rd for her funeral. And she was frozen in her casket. And that's something that I'll never forget. So on August 28th, I talked about that. August 28th, yeah, United Healthcare closed my case. We flew back for mom's funeral. And On September the 1st, we switched from United Healthcare to Blue Cross Blue Shield. That was a UH decision. On September the 10th, I returned back to work after Hurricane Harvey and Mom's funeral. On September the 11th, I was approved for proton therapy. On September the 18th, I started proton therapy. On October the 26th, I finished proton therapy. On November the 30th, I started chemotherapy. On December the 14th through the 18th, we moved offices into a new building. And on December 21st, I saw the first results of my first round of chemotherapy. And it, after all those things that I listed happened from essentially, if you look at it, you know, June 29th to about December 21st. So you're looking, you're looking at June, July, August, September, or actually if we start July, August, September, October, November, so about in a 6 month period. Yeah, well, not surprising, Bubba. I don't.
I didn't have to use my fingers,
though. I don't have very high expectations for you, so.
No, that's all right.
So all that happened in a 6 month period, and I never had an opportunity to process any of it, because I was just moving from one emergency to the next, and I remember even at my mom's funeral, people were asking me how I was doing. And I didn't know what to say. You know, my mom just died of cancer, and I was diagnosed with brain cancer, and she never knew about it. So I don't know what I'm supposed to tell you. I don't know what I'm supposed to say about it, other than I'm fine. And I remember during mom's funeral, you know, also in the Jewish religion, we take dirt and we put it on, you know, the casket, that essentially it's symbolic of, you know, the body will return back to the earth and, you know, dust to dust. And I just remember shoveling my part of the dirt and then watching everybody else shoveling the dirt and thinking to myself, my job is to stay out of that. That's my job, because I'm going to leave burying my mom, and I'm going to go back to Houston, and I'm going to be in the fight of my life. So it didn't take much after that. After I started that first round of chemo, and when I saw those results, after everything I had been gone through, it wasn't going to take much for my brain to snap. And that's what ended up happening, is that when I saw the results, I immediately went into this, you know, constant sympathetic reaction of fight or flight. And I started to experience anxiety, and the anxiety led to insomnia, and the insomnia led to depression. And there was a period of time where I didn't sleep for 2.5-3 weeks. I did not get a wink of, my brain just wouldn't shut off. I didn't know what to do. I was scared. I had never experienced anything like this before. I didn't know how to reach out. And finally, when I had a chance just to step back, I remember calling my dad and crying and like, I'm broken. I don't know what's going on. And so I reached out to MD Anderson. And I just said, look, I don't know what's going on, but this is everything that's happening. And, you know, MD Anderson said, you know, it's probably the chemotherapy, and the part of my brain that was cut out is part of my right frontal lobe. And if you know, if people know that are listening anything about that right frontal lobe, it's the control center for everything else. So it was no... You know, from a physiological standpoint, there was no, you know, there was an assumption that, you know, this was the cause of everything that was happening, and I understood that from an academic standpoint, but there was a psychological aspect that I kept trying to share with my medical team that this is everything that this is everything else that happened. And so, you know, I had contacted my neuro-oncologist, who's a great physician. His name is Dr. Carlos Camilla, and he's a phenomenal physician. And you know, I told him this is everything that was going on. And I don't know what to do, and which was, I think, a surprise to everybody, including me, because I had been rehabbing myself after the operation. I kicked PT out of my room. I wanted nothing to do with it. Apparently, I was, the only thing I wanted after the operation was chocolate milk. That was the only thing that kept me at least decent to everybody else. And I, you know, as far as the neurology residents, my neurologist is a friend of mine, Dr. Todd Mazel. He's a phenomenal neurologist. And, you know, I wouldn't let anybody in unless they could repeat for me the cranial nerves. And my wife got a video of me actually testing my second cranial nerve after the operation, that I grabbed the otoscope from the treating resident or the physician. I don't remember. It was a fellow. I don't remember what it was. But I grabbed it and was like, look, you're not testing my pupils correctly. Give it to me. And so I started testing my own pupils. And the only thing that kept me calm, I would yell at them, I'm not doing this. I'm not wearing your red socks. I'm not a stroke victim. You know, I'm a brain tumor patient, you know, all this other stuff. So, and then, you know, they would like, all right, you know, I'm just irritated and upset. And you want some chocolate milk? And, okay. And that's what calmed me down. And so, I have no idea why. Anyway, keep going. And in January, I started my second round of chemotherapy. And that second round was about twice the dose of the first. And the first was tough. Yeah, I was nauseous. I didn't feel well. It was a kick to the gut. I mean, chemotherapy by nature is designed to destroy everything, including the bad stuff. I mean, it's like dropping an A-bomb in, you know, in your body. But right now, this is the most advanced that we have for brain cancer. And so I started that second round of chemo, which was about twice as strong. And if I thought the first round was bad, the second round was, I mean, imagine you're in the ring with Mike Tyson, and you know, you've managed to last maybe a round, and you're just already exhausted after that first round, and you come back in the second round just thinking, all right, I survived the first round. And then, you know, Tyson comes out and just destroys you. That's the way it was. That second round knocked me on my butt, and I couldn't even get out of bed. And that's when all of, you know, all the anxiety, that's when it really started, because I thought to myself, I don't know what I'm going to do. If I can't get out of bed now, and this is the way, and I'm supposed to do a year of this, I don't know how I'm going to survive. I don't know, how am I going to provide for my family? How am I going to, I'm just supposed to put my life on hold for an entire year. Now, remember, it wasn't just the cancer. It was all that other stuff. So I was communicating with MD Anderson, telling him I was having trouble. So they referred me to the supportive care center, which essentially is palliative care. And I was talking with one of the physicians at palliative care, and I was telling her this is everything that's going on, and she jumped very quickly to, you have something called adjustment disorder with, you know, some mood things. And I said, why would you say that? And, you know, because I was curious, not that I was questioning her, but I was curious. She says, well, you're having trouble dealing with the fact that you've been diagnosed with cancer, which is a major trauma. And I was like, yeah, but what about all these other things? And it was as if she didn't want to hear that part. So I was just trying to understand it all. I was trying to process it all. I didn't want to miss work. I kept going to work. I was exhausted. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. And so, you know, I kept pushing forward, and everything that got me to a point in my life that I am now personally and professionally was not working anymore. So the harder I pushed, the harder that the chemotherapy and ultimately the depression and the anxiety and the insomnia pushed back. So I didn't have any strategies. I didn't know what to do. Anyway, that all those feelings of depression, anxiety, they kept going. All the methods that I had, that you learn about and that you go through, right? If you're not feeling good, then go outside, you know, go socialize. I can't because I'm in the middle of chemotherapy. Go for a walk. I can't because I don't have the energy to even get out of bed. You know, go and do something fun. I can't because I'm in this constant state of anxiety. So you have to understand that all of those things led up to just this spiral and sinking deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And, you know, I wasn't sleeping. I was always in a state of anxiety. I could not think about how to solve the problem. I could not step away from it. It was just consuming every part of me. And it was like a big black blob, you know, just, and the only way that I can describe it, Jeremy, is I was in hell. And I was in hell, and I was being consumed by depression, by anxiety, by the chemotherapy. I was being consumed by all of it. And I kept fighting, and I reached out to MD Anderson. I said, I think I really need to go see psychiatry. And I got denied. And I couldn't figure out why. And I was trying to tell him, like, look, I'm not, some of these thoughts that I'm having, I don't think are related to the chemotherapy. I think that I'm going through some sort of depression. I'm going through some sort of post-traumatic stress, you know, from all of these events, you know, that all happened in a 6-month period. So fast forward, I held on as long as I could. And, you know, I was fortunate at work, because I had Mark Knobloch by my side, and I mean, he took a major load off of me, and you know, it just was like, look, you do whatever you have to do just to get yourself right. And I was fortunate to have my wife by my side, who, I mean, was doing everything. I was nothing. I had disintegrated mentally, I had disintegrated physically, I had disintegrated emotionally. I could not fathom that this was going to be my life. So I kept fighting until May. And one day I woke up, and the only thing I could think about was killing myself, because I thought, if this is going to be my quality of life, then I don't want to live it. Which, you know, I may have been right, may have been wrong, but I don't want to live it. And so I recognized that thought, and I didn't immediately reach out to anybody because A, I was scared, and B, I didn't want to alert anybody. So that one day, that one thought turned into about a week and a half of every day, all I wanted to do was kill myself, because I was watching myself as a human being just disintegrate, and I didn't know how to get out of it. I could not see an end. I mean, I was like I said before, I was in the deepest, darkest pits of hell. And, you know, I've heard all sorts of things, you know, and there's the devil that says, you know, you're not strong enough to handle the storm. And yeah, you're right. So I only saw one way out of this. And the only way out of this was I still had a bunch of medicines that all the physicians had prescribed for me. That, you know, were anti-anxiety, sleep, you know, they would help with sleep, muscle relaxers, all of it. So one morning when I'm still not sleeping, you know, I just decided, okay, this is it. I'm going to take these pills and, that's it. I'm going to end my life. And I'm sorry. I hope my family understands. I hope my friends understand. But I cannot continue on. I'm in so much pain. I'm in pain mentally. I'm in pain emotionally. I'm in physical pain from the chemotherapy. I can't be around anybody because of the chemotherapy. You know, the chemotherapy is cyclical and it's cumulative. And so what that means is that every round destroys your body more and more. And so I'm like, all right, you know, maybe today I can just get out and I can go for a walk. And, you know, I try to go out and I'd go for a walk. And remember, at that time, it was like the worst flu season on record. So I was paranoid to be around anybody, because my white blood cell count had dropped so low. My platelets had dropped very low, which meant that if I got cut by anything, it was very difficult for me to stop bleeding. My energy levels were nothing. I mean, and what ended up happening was that even things that you would take for granted on a daily basis, brushing your teeth, brushing your hair, taking a shower, those all became overwhelming for me. Physically, mentally, emotionally. And so, you know, I just started to collapse. And like I said, it got to that point where there was no way out. My only way out was to end it. And so I took a handful of these pills. You know, I tell people I took enough to kill a rhinoceros. And, took them, downed them, and went back into bed and thought, I'm going to fall asleep and I'm not going to wake up. And I hope people understand, because I can't live this way anymore. Well, I'm here, so, right? There are bigger plans for me. And my kids found me. My wife was out of the house. My kids found me. And, you know, they thought I had had another seizure. My wife came home in emergency. I was completely out of it. I don't remember anything. I had urinated myself. It must have been hell for my kids to see. And especially my son, who is a man amongst men, he's the one that saw me seizing. So he's the one that helped me there and then did it again this time. And so my wife rushed me to MD Anderson because, you know, they thought it was another seizure. MD Anderson, you know, they never pumped my stomach. They never did anything because they didn't think it was an overdose. They thought it was another seizure based on, you know, my history. So when I was in a place where I could actually listen, you know, when I wasn't just completely out of it, you know, my wife told me the plan that, you know, I think it's another seizure. It's a, you know, it wasn't a grand mal seizure. It was, you know, I think it's a some sort of petite mal seizure. So they're going to increase my medicine. Is this one still working or no?
I don't know.
All right. Okay. So they're going to increase my Keppra, which was the anti-seizure medicine. And, you know, they're going to do another MRI and all that stuff. And I was just angry. I said, no, I'm not. I was non-compliant. You know, I'm not doing it. And nobody could figure out why. And finally, my wife had said, you know, what is going on? And I said to her, this wasn't a seizure. And she said, what was it? And I said, it was an overdose. I tried to kill myself. I mean, you talk about pissed off. So she walked out of the room, and I'll never forget that look that she gave me, because I had violated trust between the two of us. I had not shared what I was going through. I had kept it from her because I did not know how to communicate all of that. And so, you know, from there I was transferred to the neuro-oncology. I was transferred to the neuro-oncology floor, where I was put in a room. My dad flew out and was put in a neuro-oncology room, and they kept a sitter with me. So I had somebody that stayed with me in the room. My dad slept in a chair. My wife slept in the hospital the first night. My dad slept the other nights. And so I wasn't allowed to do anything. At first I'd go and get something to eat down in the lobby of MD Anderson. And then, rightfully so, some administrators made the decision that, you know, if this was a suicide attempt, I shouldn't be allowed to leave the room or the floor, which I was really pissed off about. But now looking back on it, I understand, right? So I was back in my room, and they had a sitter with me all the time, 24/7. There was somebody from MD Anderson that was sitting in that room with me, watching me. And I was just angry. I was angry at everything and everybody. I was angry at God. I was angry at the situation. I was just pissed off. And I couldn't figure out why I wasn't being heard. And you know who showed up in that room? Psychiatry. They had denied me three separate times, and now they showed up. And I told them. They said, what happened? I said, you know, I tried to communicate with you guys three separate times, but, you know, I got your attention now. So through a number of different things, the next step, which is an appropriate step, was to transfer me to an inpatient psychiatric facility, which was an appropriate place. The issue is that nobody wanted to take me because I was too medically complicated. That's the word, because I was coming from MD Anderson. Although I was completely cancer-free at the time, and my neuro-oncologist signed off on it, most psychiatric hospitals, they don't want any medically complicated cases. So I ended up going to a psychiatric facility called Bel Air Behavioral Hospital in Bel Air, which I've never been to prison, but man, this was the absolute scariest place I've ever been in my life. They take everything from you, and rightfully so, because you're in there for a reason. They took my shoelaces. They took anything that I could use to harm myself or to harm others. I mean, they took my toothbrush. You know, when you go to shower, you don't have any privacy, right? If you need to go use the restroom, you're going to use it in public. If there's a community area, you're watching TV, you've got somebody else sleeping in the room with you. The beds are nothing. It is, you know, it's just a plastic mattress that is not very thick. There's no comfort to it. You know, there's a sheet and a blanket, and that's it. You know, we're locked inside for the majority of the day. You get two or three opportunities to go outside. most people, and the outside is not, the outside is probably the size of where we are right now. Not much. The majority of people go outside to smoke. And so I would walk all the way down to try to stay away from the smoking area. I even asked one time that could I go to the other side, and they said no, because we wouldn't have enough people to watch you. And so I'd go outside, I'd stretch, I'd enjoy the sunlight. And you know, I gotta tell you, I you're in that place, they come and check on you every 15 minutes. So there's no, you got nothing. There's no doors, there's no shower heads, nothing. There's no, it's not a toilet that you would be, that you would even recognize. You don't get soap. Everything is designed so you can't hurt yourself or hurt somebody else. And rightfully so. They take everything from you. So I spent a week there. And from there, in order for me to get out of Bel Air Behavioral, I had to have some other care set up. So part of that was I needed to identify a place where I could go for outpatient therapy. And so I ended up going to a place called New Dimensions, which is close to me. And I was pissed off the entire time. I was just upset. I was upset for a lot of reasons. You know, why did this happen to me? Why did I have to go through all these other things? Why, you know, all this, just a lot of questions. And it made me question, I'm not the most religious person in the world, but I'm very spiritual. And so, but in essence, it questioned my faith in everything. And, you know, I just didn't understand. I was angry, and I sat there for the first couple days at New Dimensions in outpatient. You know, I listened to everybody's story, and they asked me if I wanted to talk, and I wouldn't really talk. Over time, I opened up, and I started telling my story, and I actually, where this list came up was, I had some time to really think about what had happened. And so I started putting down all the dates. And once I put it down on the sheet, I was like, I never even had a chance.
Can we pause with that? Because I want to touch on that real quick.
So, yeah, go ahead.
So let me back up for a minute. So with my involvement with AT's care and dealing with athletic trainers going through a crisis, what we do is confidential. Now, we're sitting here talking about your situation, and you and I have talked
sure.
in this realm. And so I'm not violating confidentiality because you're putting it out there right now. Some of the things we may bring up, I'm not going to go into detail on, but we've talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll kind of leave it at that. But I want to ask you something, because I was making notes of your dates. So you had 10 dates, in essence.
Okay.
10 life-altering things. Now, if we look at that, some of them are not truly life-altering in normal patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Denial of benefits. That happens all the time.
Right.
Right? So, by itself is not life-altering. Changing insurance. By itself, not life-altering.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Moving your office.
By itself, not life-altering.
Right. But when you add up, I'm just going to go down. You had a seizure, you were diagnosed with cancer. You were denied benefits for proton therapy. You had a hurricane come through and devastate a city. You changed insurances. Your mother died, you had to go to the funeral. You got your therapy, okay? So that's a scary time right there.
Yep.
You started chemo. You moved your office, and you got the results of your first round of chemo, all 10 of those within a six-month period of time.
Yep.
Okay? Then we fast forward to 18. You've reached out as best you understood how to do at the time, going through everything you could do, and basically nobody was listening. Now, did we put that out there in the best possible way? Maybe, maybe not, but that's not your job to do, okay? Second round of chemo, nobody was listening, okay? You got denied for psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
So you add up those three or four, and then you throw on top of that anxiety to insomnia to depression.
Mm-hmm.
And I've asked you this, and I'm going to ask it again because I know the answer, but for everybody, was there any one of those that was the straw that broke the camel's back, or was it all of those together?
As I'm able to reflect on it, it was the totality of it all, that I did not have the ability to compartmentalize any of this. And I thought I was doing a good job. I generally thought I was doing okay. And right up until chemo. And chemo, I did well through radiation. And they were surprised that I was doing so. I kept exercising. I kept my diet up. I was always in great spirits. And, as I worked through this process, I think what ended up happening was it was the chemotherapy. The first time that I felt like a cancer patient was chemotherapy.
So that we might put a little more weight on that one than others, but
maybe. And that's all it was going to take. It was just going to take one other thing. And, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. So, chemotherapy, if anybody's been through it, it's hell. I mean, it is hell. And the chemotherapy that I was on, temozolomide, is a much more tolerable form of chemotherapy than the previous chemotherapies to treat brain cancer. And the other thing too, Bubba, is that you have to understand the part of my brain that's cut out, that's your control center for everything else.
Right. And during this process, I mean, we're friends, number one, but number two, through my committee, I reached out to you and we spoke.
Yep.
And you were really down at one point. And
yep.
I don't keep records, so I couldn't tell you on this date we talked. But you were really down, and I remember asking Josh, have you talked to anybody
about
this? And you said yes.
Yep.
So, but what you had done, what was happening, was you had reached out, and they're talking to you, but they're saying, oh, it's the chemo. Now, we didn't get into that depth of the conversation, right? But they're going, oh, it's the chemo. Nobody understanding yourself, myself, the medical professionals that you're dealing with, oh, no, we're way deeper in this pit.
Right.
Than anybody ever thought.
Right.
So the other thing I'm going to ask you, and then I've got something after you go through the rest of your quote-unquote recovery, but in your 7 to 10 days when all you really thought about was killing yourself,
yep.
Did you develop a plan or did you just think about killing yourself?
Because
I think it's two different animals.
Yeah.
Personally.
So had I developed a plan? That's a really good question. I don't think I had in detail. I just think that
wanted it to happen.
Yeah, and I don't think I drew out a plan of like, all right, well, and I had thought about certain things, like if I hang myself, the issue is that coming from the background I come from, I knew too much. So like, all right, if I decide to hang myself, I have to have a certain amount of leverage and, I've got to do it at a certain angle so it snaps.
What's going to support me? And,
right.
Yeah.
Right. And so if I don't do it, I'm just going to sit there and dangle and die. That's going to be a horrible death. So, we don't have a gun in the house. We don't, I knew that, if I drank a gallon of antifreeze, that would never show up on an autopsy. It's just
too much forensic files, man.
Yeah. So, I mean, I knew, as I was walking through this, and so it was all I can tell you was that I think it was somewhere in the morning before everybody else was up. And, that thought popped in my mind.
It was there.
I still have all those medicines.
Right. You see them and go, there's my answer.
There it is.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what I wanted to touch on with that, because again, we've talked about it, but you look at it, okay, you got 10 of these situations, right? And you look at it in whole, okay, a parent dying by itself is life-altering, but is it the one? Not as a singular incident, potentially, right? But we add them all up together, plus the fact that on the back end of that, nobody's understanding what you're trying to say. You're not saying it in the best way potentially possible.
I can't.
Because you don't know how. Your brain's not functioning. Right. All these things that lead up to you can't because of whatever the reasonings are. And so in a way, you're the guy that does slip through the cracks.
Yep.
So go ahead and finish. And then, like I said, I've got really two more things I want to touch on that. Okay. And then we'll kind of go from there.
And that's the other thing I want to, you know, anybody that's listening, I'm sure you can see who's listening and who's not. Anybody that's listening, if they want to chime in and ask a question, you know, I've got, at this point, I've got nothing to hide. And, you know, my goal and my purpose, personally and professionally, is to help as many people as I can, because, you know, cancer, depression, all that other stuff. I mean, it is all consuming, and I can only speak for cancer. Cancer will, and depression, but cancer will consume everybody in its path. It will consume the patient. It will consume the patient's family. It will consume the caregivers. It is a nasty, nasty, very intelligent disease. And, I mean, it is, it's an MF-er, man. I mean, it is, I saw my mom just, I mean, it destroyed her. And it was a nasty, relentless process. I mean, and it just, it, I don't know any other way to describe it other than it's a horrible disease. And then on top of it, to learn, okay, you know, it's brain cancer. Okay. Now, I will tell you this, is that a lot of news that may, you know, a lot of people that know about brain cancer, they immediately jump to what's called a GBM, a glioblastoma. And that is a death sentence. I don't know when, you know, probably over a 3 or 4 year period. Glioblastomas are very aggressive, very deadly brain tumors. It's what John McCain had. It's what, you know, a number of other people have died from. And cancer is a very intelligent disease. It needs a place to hide, and it needs a place to contain itself. And so what ends up happening is that when somebody is diagnosed with another kind of systemic cancer, lung cancer, you know, colon cancer, whatever it is, the cancer is smart enough to know that it needs a place to hide. So typically when it metastasizes, it'll go to a place where it can be contained. It can be contained in a lung. It can be contained in the brain, right? The brain is locked in, you know, with the cranium, and it, you know, it knows it could be there and cause as much destruction as possible. It's a very, very intelligent disease. My type of cancer is what you call a primary brain tumor. And it is the World Health Organization, the WHO, it classified it as a grade 2 oligodendroglioma, which by nature is a very non-aggressive, very slow-growing tumor. They think it was growing inside of me for about 4 or 5 years before it made itself known. And obviously, as we know, I've got this divot in my head with this titanium plate. The brain will never grow back. So my brain is going through this process of learning how to compensate. And it has been for 4 or 5 years, right, since it started. I didn't do anything to cause the cancer. It just is, as we know about cancer, it's just some cell that decided to go rogue and took everything and everybody with it. So came out of, you know, went to outpatient, worked outpatient, listened to some stories. I graduated from outpatient, and I was given a coin. As a token of graduation, you know, I did it. I did what I was supposed to do. I worked that process. Discovered a lot about myself. Discovered where, you know, a lot of the anxiety was coming from. A lot of the depression was coming from. Had to come to terms with a lot of other things in my life that I'm not going to get into. And then, you know, when I left, part of your graduation from outpatient was you have to have your own personal therapist set up. They call it an IT, an individual therapist, and your own psychiatrist set up to manage your case. So I worked with my primary care provider, who's amazing. If you're in the League City area and you need a physician, Dr. Lisette Perez-Rodriguez is a phenomenal physician. So I went to go talk to her, and she referred me to a guy by the name of Dr. Peter Lee, who is the psychiatrist. And he and I spoke, and I told him everything, and he had told me, he said, look, if we can get your sleep under control, everything else will fall into, everything else will take care of. I mean, right now you're exhausted, right? And you just need some sleep. And so we went through, you know, he didn't find that magic combination right away. It took some time. And what I found really very comforting about Dr. Lee was that when I would reach out to MD Anderson, like, this medicine's not working, that medicine's not, I never spoke to a physician. I always spoke to, you know, a nurse that would call me back a few hours later, maybe a half a day later. You know, meanwhile, I'm like, I'm not sleeping. My anxiety's through the roof. I just, you know, please somebody call back. And they just didn't call back. And I've told everybody, you know, this isn't a knock on MD Anderson. This is just my experience. MD Anderson is phenomenal at cancer. They lack, in my opinion and in my experience, they lack the ability to treat the patient holistically.
And I don't think they're alone in that regard.
Yeah. I mean, it's just and what you have to understand is that cancer, you know, cancer is different than what we're used to, right? Cancer is different than a orthopedic injury. It's different than it's just a different beast, because right. A lot of people associate cancer with, I mean, that's the thing that they're most scared of. You know, it's cancer. And I worked that. I got to Dr. Lee, and he said, you know, the first thing we got to do is take care of your sleep, figure that combination out. So he tried a few combinations, you know, here and there. And, you know, there was one time he tried me on a certain medicine. I don't remember what it was, but I called him immediately and I just said, look, I tried it. I didn't sleep so good the first night. I didn't sleep so well the second night. The third night I didn't sleep at all, and now, you know, some more suicidal thoughts have started, because it's that lack of sleep that's that trigger. So I spoke to my wife about it, and she said, call my therapist. And I said, you know, her name is Michelle Cote, which she's in Dickinson. And if you need a good therapist, Michelle Cote is one. Another one in the Webster area is Pooja Mehta, both very, very talented therapists. So, you know, Jess, my wife, said, you know, reach out to Michelle. Michelle was out of town, and she said, call Dr. Lee. So I called Dr. Lee. I left a message on his service, and within 30 minutes, he called me back. And I said, this is what's going on. And he said, stop the medicine immediately. I said, all right. And I was in tears. I said, thank you so much for calling me back. And he kind of... He kind of snickered over the phone, and I'll never forget this answer. And he says, I'm a psychiatrist. I said, yeah. He says, if you're calling me, happened to be on a Sunday afternoon. If you're calling me on a Sunday afternoon on this number, it's not because you're having a great time.
Well, yeah.
And so he says, so this is serious. So he called back, and, you know, he found the right combination. And when he found that first combination that helped me sleep, he put me on. He found that right magic combination. And the first night, I slept for 15 hours straight. I mean, I was out.
Freak your family out.
Oh yeah, like I fell asleep in my clothes that I was wearing that day. I just okay, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna be on the couch, and I was done. 15 hours, and I remember waking up and thinking, did that just happen?
Yeah.
So, I mean, to the point of where I was such in a deep sleep that my wife checked on me a couple times because she thought I had died in the bed. So, you know, I thought, all right, well, that's that. And let's try it again. You know, that must have been a fluke. After everything I've been through, that must have been a fluke. So I tried it again. And then the second night, I slept for like 12 hours. And I was like, huh.
Maybe we're onto something. Yeah.
Maybe we're onto something. You know, in baseball, if you win three in a row, they call that a streak.
Yeah.
So then I tried it the third night. And I slept for like 8 to 10 hours. So once I got that under control, then my next goal was I got to figure out a way to get back in the weight room, because I had lost about 30 pounds of muscle mass through chemo. I mean, I was just disintegrating, and I was really upset about it, because I was doing great. I had lost a number, I lost a bunch of weight, before the tumor and before the operation, and I think that's what helped me get out of the hospital so quickly. And I had kept exercising through radiation. I was really proud of it. I'd made some strides, but I wanted to get back to it. So once I got my sleep under control, one day I just thought, all right, I'm gonna pack my gym bag, and I'm gonna take it to work, and I'm gonna see if I can put in a workout. So I went and I lifted weights. And I thought, that first round, I thought, all right, I'm going to lift weights, and I'm not going to do much. I'll find three exercises per body part. I'll do one set each for reps of 10. That's it. Was a little sore when I finished and thought, all right, I'm going to be sore tomorrow. Fine. Just getting back into it. Really haven't done anything in a few months. And woke up the next day, I wasn't sore. I thought, huh. So, I thought, all right, I'll go back, and I won't go back tomorrow, but I'll go back the next day. So this time I said, all right, I'm gonna do the same thing, but rather than one set, I'll do two sets. Muscle burn, feel good to sweat, all that stuff. Thought, okay, I'm definitely gonna be sore today. Woke up a little achy, a little sore here and there, but wasn't anything I couldn't handle. And then I remember the next day, I think I got on the treadmill or something like that, and I walked for like an hour. I had not walked an hour straight in months. I couldn't. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't. So then we're talking about like August, right? Still kind of hot. And so August of 2018. So it's hot, and I go and I decide, I got to mow the lawn. I haven't mowed the lawn in a long time. Like, we were paying somebody to mow the lawn and all that stuff. But I took a lot of pride in that, because I need to see the lines. And it's instant gratification for me.
Right.
So I went out, I'm like, I'm going to try to mow the lawn. And so I went to go mow the lawn, and I wasn't tired. I mean, I was sweating. Felt great to be out there in the sun and sweat and listen to the birds and all that stuff. But I was sweating. I wasn't really that tired. And at that moment, Bubba, I'll never forget, I was listening to, I want to say it was like Jack Johnson on iTunes. And then, boom. It hit. All right. It's time. This is it. It's time. And so it's time to start chipping away. Time to make a comeback. And I did. I started back in the weight room consistently. I started running again. I remember the first time I went out to go run, I ran like 2.5 miles. And I was like,
from your cage.
Oh man, yeah. I mean, people talk about the phoenix, right? That mythical bird, mm-hmm. The phoenix. What I tell people is that's how I would describe it. Is I was burnt down to the ashes, and I rose, and my wings are brighter and stronger than they've been in a long time.
With that being said,
yep.
Because that's kind of one of my questions.
Okay.
Let's go to the one. What did your medical providers do, say, change after you admitted to overdosing?
Nothing.
I mean, as far as knowing that you slipped through the cracks.
So I know at MD Anderson, I'm being used as a case study for continuous quality improvement. Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's learning in everything.
Oh, there has to be. So. There has to be. I mean, it's, Everybody that I communicated with told me the same thing, that, you know, I slipped through the cracks.
We assumed it was the chemo, and we can't assume. So, yeah.
I mean, yeah, and so MD Anderson is using me as a case study for continuous quality improvement, which is when I started to become more comfortable about sharing my story. There was a long time where I wouldn't even speak about any of this. And then one day, I was just having a conversation with another cancer patient. It was at MD Anderson, and it just all came out. And I thought to myself at that point, I have to share it.
So through this process, I'm going to guess you kind of feel like, if I can get through this, I can get through anything.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not putting words in your mouth, but that's kind of where I feel like you're at. But through this, did you learn to let things go?
Yes.
Basically, we are people that like to control things. Hey, I'm coming in with X. Hey, here's what we're going to do. We're going to make this better. You had to now know that you can only control what you can control, right? And understand, well, there's certain things can't control, so I can't fight that.
I'm not, I got to tell you that, so here's the benefit of everything that I went through. I mean, yeah, as hard as it was, as scary as it was, I wouldn't wish it on anybody. But now that I'm on the other side of it, I'm living life the first time freely. Mm-hmm. I don't have a whole lot of fear.
That flat tire, nothing compared to this or whatever it is. Yeah.
There's not a whole lot that rattles me. Mm-hmm. Before, you know, I mean, you know, before I had a pretty short temper and would fire back, and, you know, now it's, there's not a whole lot that somebody's going to say or do that's any worse than what I just went through.
Right.
So.
I think, and I will only speak for me, but I think many of us go, man, I wish I was like them. They just like, eh, you know, it's water off a duck's back. And you know, and it may bug people internally, but I can't, what am I going to do about that? I can't control that. You know, now you're like, eh.
You know. Yeah, the stuff that used to bother me before that I would obsess about and, you know, lose sleep over, it's nothing.
And I think over time with aging and wisdom and all that, we learned to take some of that and go, you know, things that 15 years ago, that would have mattered to me, like, whatever. That doesn't matter anymore. Your perspective has taken all of that stuff at once and went, screw that.
Yeah, does it? Yeah, I mean, this is what this has done. Is
it was a big positive dumpster fire in some ways. Like, oh yeah, all this stuff.
Yeah, and you know, I am very keenly aware that twice now, I should have died, but I didn't.
Right.
And so what that says to me, I'm here for a bigger purpose. And so I'm still open to, you know, I'm still trying to figure that out. And I'm not quite convinced that my purpose here is athletic training or athletic training education. I don't know what it is, but I was supposed to go through this for a reason. And I was supposed to live for a reason. And I, you know, I'll figure that out at some point. But it's changed my perspective. It's made me a better person. You know, I can't put words to it. The song that pops in my head all that time is, I forget who sang it, but I've got it on my phone, you know, Live Like You Were Dying. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. I mean, you got one shot. I find the beauty in everything. You know, I think I'm a better person. I'm a better husband. I'm a better friend. You know, I experience life, for what it is. I don't take anything for granted because I know at any point it's gone.
You can, at any point, you can wake up on the couch with EMS looking at you, and you don't have. You said, and I'm not going to dig deep into this. I'm just a little bit of curiosity from a different angle. You talked about the look your wife gave you when you violated that trust.
Yep.
Does she understand that it wasn't a purposeful violation, for lack of a better way to put it, that, again, you didn't know how to verbalize everything going on?
Yeah, you have to understand that I think that she understands that, you know, this, and I'm still in that process of recovery.
Right.
Right? Like, my brain, and this is what these are times that I have to step back. And I was very open with my department chair, Dan O'Connor, and my faculty. They know what happened, and some other people know the real story, or the whole story. And now everybody knows the whole story. There are times that, because of that right frontal lobe, that controls executive functioning. It controls impulsivity. It controls emotion. It controls a lot of stuff. So, you know, for checks and balances, I was like, look, you know, if I say something stupid that's totally inappropriate and please let me know about it. So that way I can do my own continuous quality improvement, right? And so what I did was that once I got to this other side, I started to look at themes. And I was like, all right, well, I can see myself not only in my professional life, but in my personal life, I'm demonstrating these behaviors and actions. Mm-hmm. So let me be more aware of that. That's the reason why I wear this bracelet. All right, this bracelet this bracelet was made by my daughter a long time ago. And I ended up seeing a movie recently called Mile 22 with Mark Wahlberg. It's a great movie. But he used this bracelet a lot to, you know, whenever he would make an impulsive decision or something like that, he would snap his wrist. You know, you see people do that all the time. So I was trying to figure out a way that, all right, before you do something stupid, because I'm missing this part of my brain that will never come back, think for a second. So I'll snap my, like, just take a step, and it's worked.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, for you, though, and the best way I can make this make sense is, you no longer can go from Houston to Dallas up I-45. Okay? You can't go in a straight line because of this missing aspect of your brain. You can't even go 59 up and over on 20. You're kind of going I-10 to Florida, up 95, and then back around.
Yeah.
So your brain, to process everything.
Yeah, you have to understand
it doesn't
that,
happen. You
right.
Know?
You have to understand that. You know, the cancer was growing in me for 4 or 5 years. So my brain developed these. It had already been developing these compensatory mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And it would make sense when I look back on some of the behaviors that I had prior to the, seizure. I was able to reflect. You know, it gives you a lot of time to reflect, and when you're in a psychiatric hospital, it gives you a lot of time to reflect.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot you're doing to that thing. I wrote a lot. You don't get a pen. You get a flimsy pencil. But I wrote a lot, and it was a great opportunity. I met a lot of great people. But, yeah, I mean, my brain had already developed.
Your compensatory was go up 59 in the other, and then
I mean,
removed when they take this tumor out.
Well, yeah, I mean, so you got to understand is that my brain had already been, that area of my brain had already been dead.
Right, but it had compensated, and now they're taking that plus, you know, the dead part plus. So it's like, wait a minute, our workarounds have got to start over.
So I mean, I'm in the process of training my brain, and doing everything that I've learned professionally and dealing with traumatic brain injuries, listening to very smart people in neuropsychology and neurology and neurosurgery, and listening to very qualified dietitians in terms of supplements. Like Brett Singer gave a phenomenal talk to our MAT program and our nutrition program about what they're finding in some research in terms of concussions about the amount of fish oil and also creatine. So, you know, I started that. I've been taking 4 grams of fish oil anyway, because I knew that there was some research, but I had never seen the evidence suggesting that creatine also helps in brain recovery. So I started taking that. The off-label benefit of taking creatine to help your brain function is that it also helps you with muscle power. So I've seen that result in the gym, and that's something that I'm very proud of.
With all of this, you know, they always talk about cancer survivors.
Yep.
And yes, that should be celebrated. There's no doubt it's me. There's no doubt about it. Is this, with all you've gone through, the attempt to take your life and all that, is it similar? The only way I can put it is like an alcoholic. You're always in recovery, in essence, now?
I don't know. I don't know. I can tell you that I'll be watched for the rest of my life because of the cancer. And, you know, it's a slow-growing tumor. And by the way, gliomas always come back. There is no cure. So although it's gone, at some point, the glioma will return. They all do. And I don't know why, but the benefit that I have now is that it was growing in me for 4 or 5 years. And, you know, I never had any headaches. I never had any blurred vision. I didn't, you know, there was nothing that ever stood out where I was like, something is wrong. I have to go get looked at. So the benefit now is that, you know, for the next couple of years, I'm being watched very closely every 3 months. So I go in for MRIs, and you know, it's always contrast MRIs. And I had my 6 month post chemo physical, total physical, blood work, all those stuff. So if anything presents itself now, the cavity itself, it should remain non-existent. And so the only reason why anything will ever grow in that cavity is it'll be cancer. So, you know, you want to see that blank spot in my brain. And the way that the brain will react to it is that it'll eventually collapse on itself. It'll never redevelop those pathways.
It never scars in or anything.
No, else. I mean, I'll have scar tissue.
But it's not, yeah, it's...
No. So I'll never regain that function that, you know, I once had, that everybody else has, right? That part of my brain will never function again. And so the greatest thing about the brain is that, you know, it'll develop new pathways. So that's what I'm doing everything I can to tax my brain. The benefit of what I do for work is that, you know, I'm constantly thinking, I'm constantly solving problems, I'm constantly interacting with people, all those other things. And so those are things that
go with that.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, because the brain has to adapt.
What so, Shattuck, there's been a bunch of people watching Chicken and Live, and Roland Schmidt said that he's really appreciative for you sharing your story, because he's actually had to leave from watching the show to go take his dad to an oncology appointment.
Yeah.
So thank you for sharing your story and encouraging and just giving hope. But then Shattuck, kind of similar to what Bubba just asked, is how often do you go back to that lowest point?
How often do I go back to it in terms of really think about it? Or how often do I go back and acknowledge it?
He has to think about it.
I go back and acknowledge it every day. That, there's not a day that goes by that I think to myself, I can't believe that happened. How often do I think about it? Not often, because it's not going to take much for me to go back down that black hole. But I acknowledge it every day.
You're thinking about it now, you better make that phone call again.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Oh, and I know how to do that now.
Right.
You know, and I'm still in that process of, you know, I still go through counseling. I still check in with my psychiatrist. I still go through that. And that coin that I was given when I graduated from New Dimensions, that was something that I wanted nothing to do. I refused it. I did not want to recognize it. I didn't want to talk about it. Nothing. And now I have that sitting in my at my desk in my office, so I make sure I can look at it every day. And I have it next to some challenge coins that I've been given by NASA and by the U.S. Air Force. Because it means that much to me now.
All right, so I know Bubba mentioned some, like the AT Cares program, that kind of thing. Until just recently, until you came on the podcast, I didn't know all this stuff was going on. But one of the things that I learned was just to reach out. And throughout this whole process, I was fortunate enough to be able to kind of continue the contact. And, you know, sometimes we text gym pictures back and forth, that kind of thing. So what are some of the things that you would say to an athletic trainer or anybody who is in the situation on the outside, like me to you, just as a friend, as a colleague, yeah. Coworker?
Yeah. You know, I make it a point now that if I know somebody's going through a hard time, I make sure that I call every week at the same time. Like I said, Ricky Horn, he's the father of one of my best friends. I've known Ricky, you know, for 42 years. And he's going in for a pretty extensive operation on Friday. So I make sure that I try to call Ricky at least once a week, see how he's doing, see how he's checking in. You know, and you know, that's hard, right? Because everybody's got their own life. And, you know, there are a lot of people going through stuff, and AT Cares is still fairly new development, right? And we're still learning stuff. And so it's hard, right? And one,
you don't want to be a pest.
Yeah, you don't want to be a pest. You don't want to infringe on somebody else's life. But there are a lot of times that, at least in my experience, you don't know what to do. You don't know, you know, as the patient, you don't know what to do. You don't, and I, you know, and I, people have asked me before, like, with all your knowledge, what happened? And my answer was, I'd never been a cancer patient before. Right. I had no, I mean, if this was a shoulder, a knee, if this was a concussion, if this was anything that, you know, anything that I had been trained in, if this is a rehab issue, anything. I'm like, all right, you know, Gen Med, whatever. But I had never been a brain cancer patient. I'd never been a cancer patient. I'd never been a brain cancer. And what you have to understand is that brain cancer itself is its own division. So, you know, you have neuro-oncologists that, they go through a neurology residency first, and then they go through a neuro-oncology fellowship, and it's a very specialized area of oncology because it's the brain, and it, you know, the brain obviously controls everything. So,
you know, one of the things, and Jeremy knows this, that we learned through the training with AT's Cares. I may have gone through what somebody else has gone through, but I'm not going through what they're going through. And one of my friends put it the best, I think. They lost their spouse, and they were in a spousal support group, right? And that's a good thing.
Yep.
But they said, we've all lost our spouses, but they didn't lose my spouse.
Yep.
And that sums it up, okay? You were a brain cancer patient. You don't want to have that expertise as a brain cancer patient. Nobody does, right?
Right.
The next person you talk to with it, their journey's different than your journey.
Yep.
I've been in that situation, but I'm not in your shoes. I'm not going through it.
There's
certain, you know, similarities.
Yeah, you have some empathy and compassion. It's no different than, you know, you're hearing all the soldiers come back with their own stories of war and what they went through and all these other things.
Right.
And so, you know, I always tell, you know, the cancer patients, I'll go up and I'll hug them. When I find out that somebody's a cancer survivor, there's that instant bond. Mm-hmm. There's that instant connection. And it's a fraternity that you never wanted to be a part of.
Right.
But you are. And, you know, the thing that I always say is just stay in the fight. And, this is going to be a lifelong, you know, this is a lifelong, journey for me. And, you know, one thing that I've told my wife and I tell everybody else, I'm never going back to that hell of depression again. And I'm taking all the measures and steps to make sure of that. I did learn through all this discovery that, I had a genetic predisposition for it, that my mom suffered from very severe depression. A lot of her family members were hospitalized because of depression, some suicidal tendencies. On my dad's side, so there was a genetic predisposition. My dad's side, there was some depression and anxiety and all those other things. So it was just going to be, you know, the right combination.
Right, perfect storm.
Yeah, I mean, this is what it was. And when you look at the things that, you know, happened, I still look at it, and I call it the list. I carry that list around with me every day. It's in my journal. I look at it every day because I just can't believe that I survived.
Right. You know, one of the things we do is, with AT's Care, is reach out, right? And that's important. I think it's important. Just, hey, I'm here for you. Now, you may not want to talk about it. Mm. You may not be able to talk about it from a standpoint of legal or whatever, that you can't talk about it. Or, in your case, you didn't know how. Or you didn't necessarily know how.
Yeah, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know. Because I didn't know. You know, everybody knew that I had cancer. Right? Even... up to SWATA, Chris Shattuck made a flat yelling.
Right.
And so everybody knew that, but...
And everybody knows you're struggling, you're going through trim, you're doing these things.
Right.
But
I don't think everybody knew the totality everything. Right.
I mean, we talked. I didn't know the totality, but at the time, I'm not going to go, hey, come on, you really need to talk to me.
Yeah, it was hard for me to...
But you don't know how to verbalize it because you didn't know in some ways that you couldn't verbalize.
I was just in shock.
Right.
You know, I mean, I was just in shock, and that's what it was. It was just, I was in shock for an extended period of time.
And suffering PTSD.
I mean, that's what it is.
And so I think the point being, you don't want to talk about it. You can't talk about whatever it is. Hey, I'm okay. I'm fighting. I'm doing okay. All right. I've got to take that at face value.
Of course.
I'm not going to call you a liar. I can't call you a liar. I could. I'd be wrong because I don't know the whole story.
Right.
But you kind of mentioned it, that you call that one friend the same time every week. Continued to reach out. Now, life gets in the way. Oh,
yeah.
I didn't call today. I'm going to call tomorrow.
That's all right.
I didn't call this month. I'll call next month. Whatever. But I think knowing that somebody's there or someone's people are there,
yeah,
people are reaching out. Hey, thank you. You know, there it is. That may be all you need. That may be all anyone can do, you or them or other right now. But there's something there.
I have to tell you, the other thing that I've learned out of all this, Bubba, and Jeremy, I'm going to tell you, is the humanistic component. Is that, you know, in the end, we're all here for some reason, the same period of time, going through whatever it is that we're going through, but we're all here. And so, you know, there are going to be disagreements, but don't be disagreeable. You know, sometimes... just a hug or a handshake or a, you know, a high five, something just to say, look, you know, I've been where you are. And, you know, like Shattuck asked, you know, I was in the depths of hell and I was face to face with the devil. And, the devil said that I wasn't strong enough to handle the storm. And it was only through the love and support of family and of friends that rallied, where I was able to find the strength to crawl, and then eventually stand and walk and then run and then be where I am and then finally look back and tell the devil, no, I am the storm, and to feel that confidence again. And so I think anybody that goes through any of this is obligated to turn back around and say, I made it through hell. And, you know, I've got a story to tell. And if this story goes, if this story goes to help one other person that is going through cancer, that is going through depression, that has thought about suicide, any of it, if it goes to help one person and it saved that person's life, then I'll tell the story a million times.
All right. So last thing before we wrap this up, Tanya reached out and said, you know, hey, thanks for sharing this. Cause I shared it on Twitter, kind of what was going on.
Yep.
And actually I was just sharing like one liners of your thoughts.
You scared the hell out of some people on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. And so everybody that reached out, I really appreciate that because that was the thing is I was trying to create that. Like
I was
sitting there. I read the one. I went, okay, I know what he's doing because I know what's coming up on Wednesday. So I was like, all right.
Yeah, because
I'm not on Twitter. What'd you say on Twitter?
Well, like what you said, I wanted to end my life. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't get out of bed. I was hopeless. I was anxious. Like just those one liners that you said, and you're reaching, you cried out for help at seeking help, you know, those kind of things. And so there was a lot of people, hey man, you okay? You okay? You know, tweeting, texting, emailing, that kind of stuff. And I was like, yeah, I'm just sharing thoughts of a friend. And so, going back to that, like Tanya was like, you know, I have an athlete that came to me.
Yep.
And so now any of the athletic trainers that hear your story are going to know, hey, reach out. Hey, be willing, because it can easily turn to this. And then whenever we had our athlete die, you were the first person I remember calling.
Yeah,
me. You were the first person that reached out that I remember and said, hey, I'm here for you. I've been in a similar situation. Let me know if you need anything. And so it was a great pleasure for me to be able to return the favor, I guess, in kind, but also just understanding this is what we're supposed to do because I've seen somebody do it for me.
Yeah.
And so Josh, I really appreciate you coming and sharing your story. You know, and then just everything, you know, obviously Matt saved your life twice. And so really, this is a really cool opportunity for me. And, I thank you for being willing to share your story.
Sure.
So this is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/overdose. If you're going to point somebody to one spot to reach out for help, I kind of put you on the spot there. Where would you do that? So if you want to get a hold of Bubba, it's ATC LAT Bubba on Twitter. Josh Allen, I got his email there. So Josh, if you're going to point somebody to one spot to reach out for mental health, where do you think that'd be?
The first thing I would say is, you know, if you know a qualified therapist, you know, try to reach out for help. Obviously not every case is going to be as extreme as mine. You can talk to your primary care provider. You know, because that starts the process that, but the first thing is to identify, I need help. And it's okay. You know, in today's society, there's still a negative stigma attached to mental health. But more and more people are coming out to talk about it, to say, look, you know, what they have to understand is that mental health, I'll be honest, I had a nervous breakdown. I mean, I had a complete nervous breakdown. I mean, that's what it was. And, it happens. It happens more often to people than people think. And I think the reason why I wanted to share the story more is because of the position that I hold at UH and in the athletic training community and stuff like that, that, you know, I've been trying to build my reputation up and build my career up for the last 20 years. And I've had some really cool opportunities throughout it. But this can happen to anybody. So reach out to a therapist, reach out to primary care physician. If you're an athletic trainer or if you're any healthcare provider and you're seeing somebody that is going through a hard time, don't be afraid just to ask, hey, are you okay? Are you all right? You know, and that humanistic component of things, just to know that, hey, look, from one human being to the next, I love you and I hope you're doing all right. And if you need something, all you gotta do is call and I will do what I can to help you. But on the other hand, they got to be willing to do it. I've had some people that you know my story, and they're like, I don't know what to do. You know, these are your options. And when I check in and, you know, I try to hold them accountable. Did you do it? No. Okay, let's try it again.
I think one of the things, it's that not just us in our profession, but many people, almost everyone, it's okay to ask you or someone else, are you having thoughts of suicide? We're not pushing them over the edge of completing
that. Well, I mean,
that's
task. That's a normal, people are afraid to say that because right. If you say yes, so this is the other thing I learned too. Are you having active suicidal thoughts or are you having passive suicidal
right.
thoughts?
You have to ask the question in the right manner.
Right.
But you have to ask that question.
Right. And a lot of people don't understand the difference between active and passive. The only reason why I learned the difference was because of, you know, the process that I've gone through of listening to everybody else.
That's why I asked if you had a plan.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, and I didn't at the time you had asked, no. But so passive suicidal thoughts are that the way that the mental health community is going to define it, passive suicidal thoughts is that you've thought of suicide, but you don't really have a plan. An active suicidal thought is that you've thought of suicide and you have a plan and you have potentially acted on that plan. So, you know, the first thing you have to do is, you know, and we live in Texas, and I know guns are a big deal in Texas, but the first thing you identify in, you know, if somebody's suicidal is you need to take everything away that could potentially harm them and potentially harm somebody else. And so, you know, and that's a conversation. And a lot of people get very, you know, no, I'm not doing that. But,
well, because they think if you bring it up that you're going to encourage them.
Well, and then right, and then so here's the other thing too, is that once that has been activated, this is what people need to understand. Once you feel like somebody is suicidal and you activate that process, EMS and law enforcement are obligated by law to act. And so
we're obligated by law by our profession.
Right. But that's what I'm saying, is that from that point on, right, you're obligated by law, but what are you going to do? So there's a yes, we're obligated by law to report it, but from a legal aspect, it's, as far as police are concerned, once they identify that you are a potential threat to yourself, you're going to be taken, and you'll be either taken to jail or you'll be taken to a psychiatric hospital, and they can hold you for 72 hours, and that's fine. You know, I saw a lot of that when I was in the psychiatric facility. And here's the other thing I'm going to tell you too, is that I met a lot of really interesting people, a lot of really cool people that are successful. I mean, I met in the psychiatric hospital, I met physicians, I met attorneys, I met fighter pilots, I met
all walks of life.
And I met homeless people. I met people that had just come out of prison for, you know, 25 years because of Murder One. I met all sorts of people. And you know what I learned? We're human beings. That's what it is. And you know, by the grace of God, it could have gone one way or the other. But, you know, it didn't. And so we're all human beings. And I met the same interesting people in an outpatient. I mean, the bonds that I have, and I still see some of them in the community, and you know, hey man, look, I'm proud of you, and I love you, and you know, you worked that process together, and you did it, and that's, so it has changed my life forever.
So. All right, so Josh wants to encourage one person to take action, right? So if you are that one person who reaches out, who is there for a student, who is available, or is that person that is needing to be reached out to, let us know. Email me, tweet me, message me, Bubba, Josh, that we know that this story has reached you, that has encouraged you, has caused action, or if there's a way that we can help, whether pointing you towards the AT's care program or Josh getting on a phone call with you and listening to your story as he shares his again with you.
Yeah, let me give you my personal phone number.
Okay.
It's if you want to reach out, my mobile number is 985-351-7994. Call, text. You can do whatever you want, but you know, like I said, if you know, I feel like I'm obligated to share the story, and if somebody else has a question, I have to, because I truly believe, you know, there's a saying in the scriptures, if you save one life, you save the world. And so if my story goes to help one other person, like I said, I'll tell it a million times. And so maybe my story doesn't help that person specifically, but because of our interaction, they're able to help somebody else. Then it's worth it. Then it's worth it.
All right. Again, this is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/overdose with my friend, Dr. Joshua Yellen, my other friend, Bubba Wilson. And again, it is a pleasure to share your story and to walk alongside that with you. So
thanks.
Bubba, thanks for being here. Josh, thanks for being here, sharing your story.
Before we go, one more time. Hey, Rick Horn, if you're listening, and I hope you are, remember you got three jobs to do. First job is going to that operation alive. Second job is come out of that operation alive. Third job is after you're done, stay alive. And when you're all done beating the snot out of cancer, you and I will stand at the top of that mountain. You, me, and your grandson, and we'll all stand together and look at it and say that we beat it. All right.
And that is a wrap.